From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's become a familiar occurrence, a violent event captured on videotape, replayed over and over on TV. On today's Fresh Air, a rare radio interview with Don DeLillo about his new critically acclaimed novel, Underworld, and how the communal spirit once associated with joyous events became associated with catastrophes defined by TV. Also, a talk with Whoopi Goldberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has introduced legislation to make the nation's food even safer. The bill would ban imports of fruits and vegetables from countries that don't meet U.S. safety standards.
These standards will address potential food safety problems throughout the production and distribution system, and they'll improve the sanitation and safety practices of all those seeking to sell produce in the United States market.
The government already has this power for meat and poultry. The administration will ask Congress for money to hire a large group of new inspectors to look at how other countries keep their produce safe. The U.S. United Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Association says the new rules aren't needed, and Mexican farmers have already denounced the plan. The lone survivor of the crash that killed Princess Diana will be able to leave the hospital soon. He was questioned again today by police investigators. Sarah Chase reports from Paris.
The two magistrates running the investigation did not accompany police officers to Trevor Rees-Jones' bedside this morning. It was his second round of questioning, and according to reports, he was able to remember some further details about what happened just after the Mercedes left the Ritz Hotel. This information could be useful to investigators in helping determine the behavior of photographers chasing the car. Hospital sources say Rees-Jones could leave as early as tomorrow. Police sources have also indicated that further tests on hair and tissue samples from the chauffeur indicate he'd been in a moderately inebriated state for at least a week before the accident. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Chase in Paris.
Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is in Jordan, where he met with King Hussein and Sheikh Ahmad Yassin. Yassin, who was hospitalized, is the founder and spiritual leader of the militant Hamas group. He was released from an Israeli prison yesterday. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from Jerusalem.
Arafat met with Jordan's King Hussein and later visited a military hospital where doctors are treating Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the founder of the radical Islamic group Hamas. Israel released the 61-year-old leader yesterday in what it claims was a humanitarian gesture. The Sheikh is in poor health. But there's growing speculation that the release may have been part of a complicated swap for two alleged Israeli agents currently being held in Jordan. The two men, who were holding Canadian passports, attempted to poison a senior Hamas official in Jordan last week. Jordanian officials suspect the two men were, in fact, working for the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service. Israeli officials refused to comment on those allegations. Eric Weiner, NPR News, Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 10 points at 8,025 in light trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up nearly 7 points at 1,697. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher in relatively light trading in New York with the observance of the Jewish New Year. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Trading has been confined to a narrow range prior to the report on September employment, which is due tomorrow. Today's survey on factory orders was slightly weaker than expected, and that has allowed long-term interest rates to edge lower. Computer networking stocks are up following positive comments on Cisco Systems from Schroeder & Company. And computer software issues have advanced after the Wall Street Journal reported that Microsoft is committed to delivering Windows 98 during the first 6 months of next year. On the negative side, there is weakness in insurance companies with managed healthcare operations. That's after Cigna Corp warned of disappointing earnings because of increasing medical cost. Cigna has lost nearly 10%. I'm Doug Krisner.
Eastman Kodak says it's reshuffling the management in its consumer imaging division. The unit's president, David Bean, will retire early next year and be replaced by Robert Keegan, who's now the president of Kodak's professional unit. Kodak has been battered by the strong dollar and its Japanese rival, Fujifilm. Just last week, Kodak said it would cut 200 senior and mid-level managers, or 20% of the managerial workforce. A new study is out rating the quality of health maintenance organizations. The National Committee for Quality Assurance, which accredits HMOs, has released its annual survey. It says tens of thousands of lives could be saved if every HMO performed as well as the best do. In one example, some healthcare plans screen just 90% of women at risk for breast cancer. Others screen less. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach, with over 170 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Among the most anticipated and most enthusiastically reviewed novels of the year is Don DeLillo's new book, Underworld. DeLillo has been called the chief shaman of the paranoid school of American fiction. That's perhaps best exemplified by his novel Libra, a fictionalized version of Lee Harvey Oswald's life. The new novel, Underworld, begins on a day in 1951 framed by two events, the Giants winning the pennant with a surprise home run, and the Soviets testing the atom bomb. In a New Yorker article about DeLillo, David Remnick wrote, "Many of DeLillo's old themes are in Underworld, the increasing power of the image and the media in the modern world, the uncertainty of American life after the Kennedy assassination, a sense of national danger, men and women who live outside the mainstream of ordinary life and language. But more often, Underworld is a darkly funny satire of post-war language, manner, and obsessions." I asked DeLillo why he chose the baseball game and atom bomb test to frame his new novel. He told me he was checking out the baseball game in an edition of the New York Times from October 4th, 1951, and he found the story of the bomb test.
It struck me with the force of revelation. On the front page of the Times, there was a headline on the left about this legendary, what is now a legendary ball game, Giants capture pennant and so on. And on the right side of the front page, symmetrically matched three columns, a three-line headline, the same typeface, Soviets explode atomic bomb. Something about the juxtaposition of these two events made me think there was something here I wanted to explore. I wasn't sure at the moment quite what. What I did feel was a sense of the power of history. And through the 5 years it took me to write the book, it began to occur to me slowly that, in fact, there is a kind of relationship between this ball game, this particular ball game, and that atomic test on the other side of the world.
What do you think the relationship is?
Well, I think that the ball game was a unifying and largely joyous event, the kind of event in which people come out of their houses in order to share their feelings with others, and an event not primarily defined by television. There was only limited coverage. With the onset of the bomb, the communal spirit becomes associated with danger and loss rather than with celebration. And the sense of catastrophic events framed and defined by TV grows ever stronger. Assassinations, terrorist acts, even natural disasters. In my private little history text, this ball game marks a kind of transitional moment between the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War.
You've said that murders actually draw us together. You know, you're talking about the crowd either being a crowd expressing its joy or coming together because of catastrophe. You've said murders draw us together. They draw people together in ways that only the most disastrous contemporary events can match. We depend on disaster to consolidate our vision. And there's a murder that is captured on videotape and is shown over and over and over again on television in your new book. And it's a murder by the Texas Highway Killer, who's a sniper who shoots at motorists driving by. And this is accidentally captured on tape by a girl with a video camera. I'd like you to do a reading from a passage about this. This is from your new book, Underworld. Feel free to introduce it for us before you read.
The videotape is a curious contemporary phenomenon, and it is marked in a way by repetition. Such tapes always seem to be characterized by violence or tragedy, and I've begun to get the idea that this endless repetition, the re-showing day after day of a particular tape until its power dwindles and another tape replaces it, I begin to think that this is almost our last perception of nature. That is, the violence we see on these tapes is not choreographed movie violence. It is violence in its natural state, caught in some cases accidentally, casually. And so it has a kind of base reality. It is real, it is taped, and it is shown repeatedly.
Maybe you could do the reading now.
It shows something awful and unaccompanied. You want your wife to see it because it is real this time, not fancy movie violence. The realness beneath the layers of cosmetic perception. Hurry up, Janet. Here it comes. He dies so fast. There is no accompaniment of any kind. It is very strict. You want to tell her it is realer than real, but then she will ask what that means. The way the camera reacts to the gunshot, a startled reaction that brings pity and terror into the frame, the girl's own shock, the girl's identification with the victim. You don't see the blood, which is probably trickling behind his ear and down the back of his neck. The way his head is twisted away from the door, the twist of the head gives you only a partial profile, and it's the wrong side. It's not the side where he was hit. And maybe you're being a little aggressive here, practically forcing your wife to watch. Why? What are you telling her? Are you making a little statement? Like I'm going to ruin your day out of ordinary spite? Or a big statement, like this is the risk of existing. Either way, you're rubbing her face in this tape and you don't know why. It shows the car drifting toward the guardrail, and then there's a jostling sense of two other lanes and part of another car, a split-second blur, and the tape ends here, either because the girl stopped shooting or because some central authority, the police or the district attorney, or the TV station, decided there was nothing else you had to see. This is either the 10th or 11th homicide committed by the Texas Highway Killer. The number is uncertain because the police believe that one of the shootings may have been a copycat crime. And there is something about videotape, isn't there, and this particular kind of serial crime. This is a crime designed for random taping and immediate playing. You sit there and wonder if this kind of crime became more possible when the means of taping an event and playing it immediately, without a neutral interval, a balancing space and time, became widely available. Taping and playing intensifies and compresses the event. It dangles a need to do it again. You sit there thinking that the serial murder has found its medium, or vice versa, an act of shadow technology, of compressed time and repeated images, stark and glary and unremarkable.
That's Don DeLillo reading from his new novel, Underworld. I think it's a kind of interesting coincidence that this comes out right after the death of Princess Diana in the auto accident, when America just watched over and over and over again the same video footage of the totaled car in the tunnel. And that seemed to like hold everybody together, watching it over and over again.
I'd rather not say too much about that particular tragedy, because just about everything has been said. But it is curious that it was an event not just overproduced and over-orchestrated by the subsequent media coverage, but an event, as some people think, partly caused by the media, and in a terrible and grotesque way. This makes it perfect for our time.
You know, the idea of watching a murder captured accidentally on tape over and over again reminds me, of course, of the Zapruder film and of the real-life TV murder of Oswald by Ruby. I mean, did you see that as it happened?
I did not see it as it happened, no. I found out about it later in the day, and I suppose that particular moment, happening only 2 days after President Kennedy himself was killed, marks a very curious transition. You know, Kennedy was killed on film. His death was a home movie. Oswald was killed on television, as if to mark the social difference between these two men. The Zapruder film became a very exclusive entity. You could not see the Zapruder film unless you were willing to pay a great deal of money to see it. It was not shown publicly in this country until the mid-1970s, whereas Oswald, on videotape, was shown repeatedly and for years and years.
Did you see violent? I should mention, as our listeners know, that your earlier novel, one of your earlier novels, Libra, was about Oswald, and a fictionalized version of Oswald, the Kennedy assassination, and the people investigating it. Do you see violent news as replacing theater in the American mind?
It seems to be replacing a number of things. The impact of the news seems far greater now than it used to be, and it's not necessarily substantial news. We seem to pay less and less attention to substantial news and to devote a greater amount of our energies to news that seems to have a kind of tabloid emptiness at its heart. And in a curious and very, very subjective way, I associate this with something that seems to be happening as a result of the end of the Cold War. That is, that events used to be calibrated to the phenomenon of awesome Cold War conflict. Even events that had no connection to the U.S. or the USSR. This curious measurability has disappeared with the end of the Cold War, and it's left a kind of vacuum in which news itself, regardless of its substance, becomes an important element in our lives.
I think, it gives us something to talk about. You know, like whether we're talking about the baseball game or the latest murder, it's something we have in common with strangers that we could talk about.
Well, I suppose that's true. There is a sense in which the darker the news is, the more important it seems to be to people. It's almost as though the narrative of our time is transmitted in the form of dangerous and sometimes catastrophic news. This is the narrative that perhaps has replaced the novel in a curious sense.
Don DeLillo is my guest. His new novel is called Underworld. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Don DeLillo, his new novel is called Underworld. You've said that the thread running through your books is living in dangerous times, and no one seems to be able to write about your themes without using the word paranoia. What do you think those are, your themes?
In Libra, there was clearly a sense of conspiracy that informed the book, and it was a conspiracy that tended to be perpetrated by a small number of individuals plotting in the shadows of our society. In this book, in Underworld, there is a different kind of distrust and suspicion. It does not seem to arise from individual plots so much as from the overarching technology that informs our lives. From the vast number of systems connections that take place beyond our comprehension, I think this makes us more prone to half-belief. We tend to half-believe everything and to maintain conviction in nothing. I think there is a direct connection in this decade between technology and paranoia, and it's interesting that there is such a paranoid presence on the internet, which is the ultimate source of our individual concerns with technology.
Do you spend a lot of time looking on the internet?
No, I've spent just a little time on the internet.
You know, what you're talking about, the connection between technology and paranoia, I think comes together in a character who's a waste management specialist, and part of what he specializes in is toxic waste. So he has to find ways of getting rid of very dangerous things.
This is one of the underworlds, I suppose, that the title refers to. The very substantial and dangerous underworld of toxic waste. For many years, people talked about the weapons of the Cold War. We devised beautiful and resonant names out of mythology for these weapons. The weapons themselves were beautiful. The explosions they produced were awesome and almost godly. At the same time, no one said much about the waste that these weapons were producing. Now this waste is being buried in the ground. And it's an interesting coincidence that the word plutonium derives from the name Pluto, Pluto the god of the underworld, which is another reason why the novel bears the name it bears.
My guest is Don DeLillo, and Underworld is the name of his new novel. The first phrase in your new novel is, he speaks in your voice, American. What is American to you?
When my books were first translated into French, I was delighted to find that on the first page of the French edition, the statement that this book was translated from the American, not from the English, from the American. And I think the language I use, particularly in this novel, is the American language. Very hard to translate, in fact. And steeped in American rhythms, slang, all those special languages ranging from baseball to the slick locutions of advertising to the Italian-American slang of the Bronx. That's the language I'm referring to when I say American. And the people I'm referring to are people of diverse backgrounds, beginning with the immigrants of the early part of this century and their children.
You've had to go back to some of the nouns of the 50s, you know, certain products and styles and ad slogans, foods that we don't eat anymore. Were there words that you rediscovered in writing Underworld that you found to be particularly evocative of the period?
One of the pleasures of this book was rediscovering the language of the 1940s and 1950s. I'm not sure I can cite particular words, but when I tried to reconstruct the street argot of my own background in the Bronx, one of the curious pleasures of this endeavor was figuring out spellings for such strange words, words that in many cases I don't think ever found a life outside those narrow neighborhoods.
Such as?
Well, there's a curious word, brouch, which I've never heard spoken anywhere outside the Italian Bronx. And the word means to welsh on a debt, essentially. If you say to me, "You owe me $20, DeLillo," I say to you, "It's a brouch." This means you're not getting it. Where does this word come from? Well, I think it comes from an Italian word that means to burn. In other words, I am burning you for this money. But I've never heard it since I was 17 years old.
You know, you've talked about the Cold War bringing a certain climate of fear and uncertainty, but you grew up in, you were born in the late 30s, so some of your formative years were during World War II. So really early on in your life, you were exposed to fear and uncertainty. Do you think you were shaped at all, that your sensibility was shaped at all by the war, which you must have heard something about? It wasn't being fought in your neighborhood, obviously, or even in your country, but still, it was on the radio. You might have had family who were fighting.
I think I was too young, in fact, to have been deeply influenced by it. I think the Cold War had a deeper effect. And I think there were two levels of danger that we experienced in those years. Obviously, the possibility of a nuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union. But there was also a psychological sense that flowed from the assassinations and social disruptions of the 1960s. And even though I was older then, I think these things shaped my work, surely, more than anything I experienced when I was 8 or 9 or 10.
Don DeLillo, his new novel is called Underworld. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with novelist Don DeLillo. And Whoopi Goldberg talks with us about her name, her work as a cosmetologist in a funeral parlor, and why she doesn't like to be called an African-American. She has a new book. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Don DeLillo. His new novel, Underworld, is a dark satire about American pop culture and paranoia during the Cold War. I believe both your parents were Italian immigrants, and I'm wondering if they spoke Italian a lot in the house, and if you were, as a boy, exposed to two languages at the same time, English and Italian.
I was exposed to two languages, but we were brought up as American kids, and I spent my younger life, playing in the streets, every sort of street game ever devised. The last thing kids my age in those days wanted to do was to appear to be European. And to my regret, I would say that I did not master Italian as a youngster and speak only a kind of sporadic Italian now.
Do you think that hearing a lot of your Italian in the house and in the neighborhood affected your ear for language in any way, even though it was something you wanted to really avoid at the time? Maybe it was even an embarrassment to you at the time.
Well, the language in my work, which is the only language that matters to me, really, is so deeply woven in consciousness that I'm not sure I can understand how it began to manifest itself. I do know that I have a curious relationship to the page. I use an old manual typewriter, largely because of the sensuous sensation of hitting the keys and watching and hearing the hammers strike the page. And I have a kind of audio-visual connection to language. That is, I'm not only aware of the rhythms of my sentences, which is something I think that characterizes my work, but I'm also conscious of the physical appearance of those alphabetic units that compose a given word. There is a relationship between certain letters that strikes me in a rather important way. And it was only recently that I was reading the afterword to a translation of the Odyssey, in which the translator Robert Fitzgerald mentions, in connection with Greek letters, the cut or sculpture of these letters, which is exactly what I respond to while I'm writing. It's a process that seems to happen automatically.
Visually, you're talking about?
Visually, yes, absolutely. Certain words will arrange themselves based in large part on the connection, the shape of the letters in those words. I might connect a word like dull with a word like lurid, which has an L, which has a D, which has a U, largely because of the visual relationship the two words have. This happens not through painstaking writing and rewriting. It tends to happen automatically.
Do you also read the sentences out loud as you're writing to see how the rhythms sound?
No, I don't. I hear it. And I hear it as it happens, and rarely have to revise a sentence on the basis of rhythm alone. These things seem to arrange themselves.
The point of view in your novel shifts several times, and often you're sometimes writing in the second person, in the you.
Yes.
That strikes me as a very difficult form to pull off, to keep up with. And I'm wondering why you chose to write in the you, in the second person, when you did, and what it means to write that way, you know, what the difficulty is.
I think it all derives from the first sentence of the book, "He speaks in your voice." I decided that periodically I would return to that second person singular, sometimes, in fact, it becomes second person plural. And I think it was a way of continuing the theme that is announced in the first sentence, that there is a connection between us, those of us who are Americans, despite our very different origins, our very different orientations. The you is a unifying you, And I think one of the things early in the book that, connects people is the voice of the baseball announcer, Russ Hodges, a voice heard, of course, beyond the borders of the stadium where the game is being played, heard by people on the stock exchange and by people in kitchens and by people in bars. And this is the first connective thread in a book that eventually connects many things.
Don DeLillo is my guest. His new novel is called Underworld. Your new novel is filled with, you know, important themes about crowds and individuals, about consumerism and danger and murder and the Cold War and the importance of baseball in the lives of Americans. And you're doing this at a time when a lot of fiction and a lot of memoirs have really focused on personal relationships, on the family, on a much smaller, more circumscribed and intimate world. And I'm wondering if you feel that you're intentionally doing that. You know, that you're intentionally looking for bigger themes at a time when a lot of fiction is focusing on something very personal.
Fiction will always explore those small and semi-concealed corners of experience, and it should, and it will, but my own fiction tends to be drawn to the wider culture. I think a writer, I think any artist is finally helpless against the tendency of his own perceptions. Basically, I do what I'm driven to do. It's not the construction of a personal philosophy. I do feel, I do absorb things around me, and I do tend to move toward larger themes, things that could not have been written by writers working 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, because these things did not exist in the world in the way in which they do now.
You have tried to remain a private person in the face of your success as a writer. And I'm wondering if you think that the same instinct that makes you want to, you know, avoid a lot of personal publicity and personal exposure has to do with the instinct that keeps you writing fiction about larger themes as opposed to a more autobiographical fiction. A lot of fiction is kind of veiled autobiography. Yours isn't, or doesn't seem to me to be.
No, it certainly isn't. I think this is a society that absorbs everything in the name of consumer consciousness. And I think the writer has to try to stay unabsorbed. He has to try to avoid becoming a kind of universal elevator music. He has to maintain a certain tacit opposition to the corporation, the state, the whole process of consumer consciousness, of white-hot consumption and instantaneous waste. He has to stand apart, in other words.
You're very interested in the subject of celebrity and what it means in America. You wrote about that a lot in your novel, Mao, too. And you also write about that in Underworld, in the opening scene at that baseball game where the Giants win the pennant. You know, Frank Sinatra and Jackie Gleason are in the stands. And you write, the crowd uses Sinatra for a reference for everything that happens. Somebody makes a nice play, they look at Frank to see how he reacts. The beer vendor trips on a step, they look at Frank to see if he has noticed. Why do you think celebrities become reference points like that?
Someone in the book says that celebrities are the master spirits of the age. It's hard to say what it is that makes certain people more famous. Surely there's a personal magnetism that's an important part of it. And in these days, the press of public events has become greater than it was before. And there's a kind of hunger for transcendence. And it is first and foremost the famous person, the celebrity, even the empty celebrity, who satisfies this urge. Celebrities take us out of ordinary life, and into a kind of specious higher state.
Don DeLillo, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Don DeLillo's new novel is called Underworld. Coming up, Whoopi Goldberg. This is Fresh Air. Whoopi Goldberg has a new book in which she shares her thoughts on everything from race and political correctness in comedy to flatulence. Whoopi Goldberg made her film debut in 1985 with The Color Purple. She's since starred in comedies like Sister Act and Ghost, as well as the drama The Long Walk Home. She's co-hosted Comic Relief, emceed the Academy Awards, and recently starred in the musical A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, becoming the first woman to replace a man in a Broadway show. I asked her about a statement she makes in her new book. She says, "Don't call me an African-American. Why not?"
Because I'm not. I'm an American. I've been here a long time. My family goes back very, 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 very far. I'm part of an immigrant group that was brought to this country against their will and have been here ever since. So to me, having worked the land and built the country along with the Chinese and all the other immigrant groups that have come here and have established themselves as Americans, I feel I fall into that category. I'm not newly here, so if I had just come from Zimbabwe, you know, two generations ago, I might be a Zimbabwe American, but I'm not. I'm an American American.
Did going to Africa make you feel any more or less strong about not wanting to be called an African American?
Well, they just laugh at us. They think we're very funny because they think we're running away from taking care of business in our own culture, in our own country, as trying to establish ourselves as part of another country, which we know not a whole lot about. And I guess the point really is Rosa Parks did not ride that bus, so I would have to be able to call myself an African American to find some identity. My identity here is as an American. America has to figure out what its identity is. And it's made up of immigrant groups, so it's kind of hard to know what the problem is.
Now, you grew up in Manhattan, in Chelsea, I believe.
Right, right.
That must have been a pretty ethnically mixed neighborhood.
Very. We were all New Yorkers. Before
right.
you were anything else, you were in New York. Yeah. You know, the rest of the world was whatever it was. But you grew up speaking a smattering of, you know, every language that you came in contact with if they had kids. So you had Spanish and Greek and Italian and Islamic. You had Japanese. You had Chinese. You had every conceivable group of people lived in our neighborhood.
You started performing when you were 8 with the Helena Rubinstein Children's Theater?
Right.
What was that?
It was Helena Rubinstein decided she was going to give money to various places under a foundational title. And I live near a settlement house called the Hudson Guild. And Helena Rubinstein opened with her foundation, opened a children's theater there. And so that's where I went after school. And I was a teapot, and sometimes I was an elf, occasionally a bunny, you know.
Did you love it?
Yeah. Where else in the world could you pretend to be a bunny and not have people just lock you up?
You dropped out of high school. Did you know where you were heading?
No. No, I don't think I did, and I don't think any kid does. And that's probably a good thing. I always knew what I wanted to be, but I didn't necessarily know where I was heading.
So you knew you wanted to act?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could be anything as an actor. You know, you could be a queen, you could be a king, you could be a cat, you could be anything. You could be a fairy in a story. You could do anything in the theater. It's a wonderful outlet.
You married briefly, then had a child.
Wasn't that brief. I was married for a couple of years and had a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then raised the child as a single mother.
My daughter, yes. I raised her as a single mother. Then I was on welfare when I was in California. And then I went to beauty school because someone was kind enough to give me a scholarship to the Duluth Schools of Cosmetology, where I learned to roll hair and spray it and tease it within an inch of its life, to cut it and make it look like Farrah Fawcett's hair or Dorothy Hamill if you wanted the wedge. And began also working with a group of people at what became the San Diego Repertory Theater, and worked on some dead people in my time, worked on dead folks.
But you were a cosmetologist or a hairdresser in a funeral parlor.
Yes.
Did you have to blow dry the corpses? Excuse me for asking.
Sometimes.
Really?
Yeah.
Were you spooked at all by that?
Only when it was children. Mm-hmm. You know, I kind of looked at what I was doing as a loving gesture, kind of making people look good for their families and making their families feel a little bit better about having lost someone, because the last time they saw them, they looked really good. And, you know, people would come up and say, thank you, you know, and you know that you ease their grief just a little bit. It was a very, it's quite a job.
How did you get it?
The hours were good, and somebody referred me, because I was doing a lot of theater. And, you know, you have to sort of be loose for rehearsals and performances, so you could make your hours.
When were you able to give up welfare and support yourself?
82, I think, 83.
What was the turning point?
My show. Once I started doing my show, I didn't need to. I could make as much doing my show as I could on welfare.
Did your show, your first one-person show, come out of your improvisational work?
Some of it, yeah. Some of it did.
Tell me about that early improv, what the approach to improv was like that you were developing.
Well, you know, you make it sound like I was doing something deep.
Right.
You know,
right.
It wasn't that deep at all. We would get together and do these shows at these clubs, and people would yell out stuff, and you'd have to do a scene. You know, you'd have to improvise something having to do with the thing that they yelled out. And after four or five beers, you know, people would yell out really dumb stuff, and it just made your imagination go, because if you weren't funny, you didn't get paid. So you had to really be entertaining. So that's how that all came about. But I love improv because it's a sharper way to look at doing the work.
My guest is Whoopi Goldberg. She has a new book. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Whoopi Goldberg. The turning point in her career was her one-person show, in which she played several characters, including a junkie who visits the Anne Frank Museum, a surfer girl who gets an abortion, and a black girl who dreams of having blonde hair like movie stars. Through that show, she met Steven Spielberg. Now, I understand that for Steven Spielberg, you did a little personal performance of What If E.T. Landed in Oakland.
Yeah, I had been doing a piece for years called Bleet, which was about the black E.T., because E.T. never seemed to land in rough neighborhoods. And everybody said, don't do this piece for him, he's not going to like it. But as it turns out, he loved it, because I did it anyway. Because I thought, if he's not going to like that, he's not going to like the rest of what may come down the pike with me. But he turned out to be much more flexible than people realized.
So Spielberg went on to cast you in the leading role in The Color Purple. And I'm wondering what it was like for you to make your movie debut in a leading role in a major motion picture. It's a lot to carry that first time out.
Yeah, it was. But Steven was really like a nurturing parent with me. He gave birth to my performance and never let me feel like I was, you know, not held, you know, not supported. There was never a question of that.
It was a very controversial film because a lot of people, particularly men, thought that it was a very anti-male, particularly anti-black male movie. That was the way a lot of men interpreted it. And so I'm wondering what it was like for you to have to, in some circles, assume a kind of defensive position for your first movie, which won you rave reviews and, you know, was really quite a debut.
Well, I think it hurt quite deeply because I didn't understand what the controversy was about. Alice wasn't saying that this was all black men were. She was writing about a specific time and a specific place that she had in her head. And, you know, censorship is censorship no matter how you try to frame it. And I thought that that's what they were trying to do, was censor her freedom of expression. And I thought a lot of people were needlessly annoyed with Steven for making the movie of this very wonderful book that no one else wanted to make.
You mean people who were saying, why did a white man make this movie?
Yeah, you know, I didn't understand the difference. He understood the material, he made it.
I want to get back to something you say in your book. You write about your daughter who, when she was 14 years old, got pregnant, and you and she had to talk about whether she was going to keep the baby or have an abortion. And you, of course, have been a strong advocate of choice,
right,
for women. Your daughter decided
made a choice and decided
to keep the child.
Yes,
I'm wondering how much you wanted to be in on that decision. In other words, how much you wanted to influence her in that decision. You had been a single mother. Your mother had raised you for many years as a single mother, too. You knew how hard it is and also how rewarding it could be. So how much did you want to influence her in making the decision?
Not at all, because it would not have been her choice then. And I figure when they're old enough to get pregnant, they're old enough to tell you what they want. Getting pregnant is a big old signpost. And when a young girl gets pregnant, it's to tell you something. And what she was saying was she wanted someone who she could be in charge of. And, of course, you know as a parent that that's not all it is. But it was her choice, and we said, okay, we're going to stand behind you, and we'll help you learn to parent. And that's what we did.
Were you concerned about how much this was going to have an impact on your own life as a grandmother? In other words, how much time you'd end up having to spend?
Oh, no. It wasn't a consideration. It was simply, okay, we have something we have to deal with now. And so that's what we did. And we spent time together, and my mom was involved, and my brother was involved, and I was involved, and my daughter was involved. And now there's this really kind of great 8-year-old running around, and we were lucky. We're one of the lucky families, because not every kid has a family who is willing to say, okay, let's all deal with this together. And so it all worked out very well for us, I'm happy to say.
Whoopi Goldberg is my guest. There are times in your new book that you use your birth name, which is Karen.
Right.
Your full name, I guess, was Karen Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Did it take you a long time to publicly reveal your real name?
I didn't do it. People Magazine did it for me, along with my address.
No, really?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Better your name than your address, huh?
Well, I thought neither one, you know, was okay, because I thought I would like to have one piece of territory that was mine, so I could get my mail without problems, so I could apply for loans without having to be under the scrutiny of the general public. Unfortunately, People Magazine changed all of that, and once it was out, it was out.
Why did you take a stage name in the first place? Did you think when you were starting out that you'd be so famous that having anonymity would be a problem at some point?
No, it was just a funny name because I'm very flatulent. And it stuck, and I became Whoopi, then I was Whoopi Cushion, then I was Whoopi Cushion, and it just sort of ran amok from there. And, you know, that's what it was. It never, you know, the idea of becoming famous was never really like something I thought a great deal about. I always knew I would be an actor. I figured I'd be a working actor. Didn't occur to me I might be making movies, but I hoped that I would be. But no, the need for anonymity isn't something that I came upon until quite recently.
And what about Goldberg?
What about it?
How'd you use that name?
How did I get that name?
Yeah.
Now, how do you think I got it?
Well, I wasn't sure whether you ever married to someone named Goldberg or you just chose it as a kind of odd juxtaposition.
What would you do if I told you it's one of my family names?
Well, that's what I said. I wasn't sure whether...
I didn't marry to
him. Oh.
Yeah. See?
Was your father Goldberg?
My mother has Goldbergs in her family.
Oh, yeah. So you use part of the family name for that. Now, did you like the incongruity of Whoopi and Goldberg together?
Well, I don't think I... You know, you're making me so deep. I was never that deep. I was always very surface. It sounded funny, and I loved it. And my mom said it sounded funny to her. And she said she didn't think Whoopi Cushion was the way to go. So, you know, it wasn't this conscientious decision to build this thing that has become Whoopi Goldberg. It just wasn't that deep. You know how you were talking about earlier, stumbling into things?
Mm-hmm.
That's been basically most of my career. I've been stumbling into it and having a good time at it.
Well, a pleasure to talk with you. I wish you good luck with the new book, and thank you very much for
talking with us. All right.
Whoopi Goldberg has a new book called Book. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Our intern is Katie Balser. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Next archive edition of Fresh Air, an interview with Patti Smith. And we'll hear from her longtime guitarist, Lenny Kaye. Patti Smith has a new CD called Peace and Noise. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.